I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining us in our ongoing quest for the awe and wonder that await each of us every day and all around. Awe can be found in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, in spiritual encounters that move us beyond words.
Last Monday, I got to film a real miracle. I got to film the egg hatching. That required me shooting straight down between branches to an egg the size of a Tic Tac, and you can actually see it crack open and the little chick emerge. There are some sequences where you can see the little chick through the shell, because the shell is so thin that as the chick starts to poke its beak through the shell, it contacts the shell, and you can tell that there's something inside the shell there, so you get to watch it poke these little holes and then start to stretch itself out and expand on the little crack that it started. It took about an hour for that little chick to get out of the shell, and I was filming from about 12, 15 feet above. I literally was in my bedroom with the window open and the camera just pointing straight down. It's some of the most fascinating footage that I've ever been able to achieve.
That's Eric Pittman, and he is not a National Geographic explorer. The tip-off for you here is that he was filming from his own bedroom window, not after taking one domestic and three international flights plus a jostling jeep ride down into some deep, dark jungle. No, Eric's got a day job selling windows right at home in his own city, Victoria, British Columbia. So not a professional explorer, but he is somewhat obsessed.
I will call it an obsession, a healthy obsession. Let's call it that.
With hummingbirds.
Some guys have boats. Some guys go hunting. Some guys play basketball. I film birds.
On Constant Wonder, we frequently feature experts from around the world who work in fields as diverse as astronomy, architecture, ancient history. But we feel a special excitement whenever we come across someone like Eric Pittman, a regular guy who has chosen to be extraordinarily observant, often with a camera in hand. The result being that he has seen marvels easily overlooked. You're talking kind of like a scientist, but I happen to know that you're not really, are you?
No, but I play one on the radio.
Self-deprecating humor aside, Eric Pittman has quite a following on Facebook with 60,000 followers. His page is called Hummingbirds Up Close. He was also the subject of a 2024 award-winning documentary titled The Bird in My Backyard. He's truly the perfect type of person for us to hang out with on this podcast, somebody who has a developed sense of constant wonder. His insights about the life of a hummingbird may just inspire you to look a little closer at what's happening just outside your own window. Eric Pittman has always had a soft spot for nature from his childhood days in Nova Scotia, where, like many children, he spent hour after hour in the woods.
My dad wanted to go hunting with me, so we would get our 22s and we'd go out to go hunt rabbits, say. But I could never shoot at them. We never did. We never. My father and I never shot an animal, although we went hunting a lot. We got a lot of cans, but we never shot any animals. And that I've just never wanted to kill an animal.
That harmless disposition of his held true even when, as a young adult, he found himself out in extreme wilderness. Now, anyone venturing far enough into the backcountry, well, that's a place where even the most rational people, when hungry enough, do feel justified in killing something to eat. Well, there are choices to be made. Maybe you've seen the TV survival series Alone. Eric was never a contestant for that show, but in the early 1980s, he did work as a helicopter bush pilot in the Yukon, ferrying supplies to remote camps and villages. During that time, he experienced a lot of solitude, far away from anything civilized.
I was up in the Yukon around Watson Lake or up in northern Saskatchewan around Uranium City and Lake Athabasca. So I spent some time flying in the Great White North, and I would spend a lot of time in the wilderness there. And even at those times when the food was late coming to camp or something, I couldn't shoot anything. I was the most disappointing survivalist.
Which is not to say that he felt no affinity for that wild place.
I got my first job in Buffalo Narrows, Saskatchewan, and I only got it because I was the only guy that stuck around. I wasn't the best pilot. I wasn't the boss's favorite. In fact, he hoped that I would go home. But at the end of a month of interviewing people, I was the only guy still there. Everybody else had gone off.
Last man standing.
I was the last man there. So he pointed to his hangar, and he said, there's three wrecked helicopters behind that hangar. Here's some wrenches. Here's a book. If you can build a helicopter out of those wrecks, you can fly it all summer. So I did. And I flew it all summer. And when I came back at the end of the summer, my helicopter was the only helicopter in his fleet that was still flying.
Oh, my.
But during that summer, just so you know the level of support that I had no radio. All I had was a paper map with a couple of circles on it as to where I was supposed to go and dates as to when I was supposed to meet people. And if I didn't show up at those places on those dates, a couple of days later, somebody would call the search and rescue crew and try to find me. But there was literally no way anybody would ever find you. I learned early on just to rely upon myself. But the great part about my job was that I could always take the helicopter and fly to the top of a mountain and just sit there for an afternoon. If I wasn't needed on that day, I literally got to go to the tops of mountains where nobody else has ever been and just relax and watch the earth beneath me. It truly is amazing, Marcus. I remember flying over the northern expanse of Canada, and for hundreds of miles, there is no sign of human habitation. You won't see a road, you won't see a house. When you finally start seeing roads, it's just a tiny little strip of land with a couple of little houses along the side. But for hundreds of miles, it's just wilderness. And you start to realize just how fragile a human being is in this majesty of nature. I remember one moment when I was flying from Prince Rupert to Watson Lake in the Yukon, and I was flying up the Portland Canal, had got to Stewart, and now I had to wind my way through the mountain valleys to Watson Lake. And I was flying by myself, and just VFR, which is visual flight rules, and I looked down from my pilot seat from about 5,000 feet, and I was just so awestruck by what I could see, and I was so blessed at being able to see the planet from this vantage point. Anybody looking from the ground would just see a speck in the sky, and I would transverse the sky and never register on their meter. In that flight, I was so overcome by the beauty of the land. I remember looking down a mountain valley and just marveling at how wonderful it was and how blessed I was to be there. Nobody gets to be there and see the world from that point of view without some kind of divine intervention, which is how I feel about being able to view these things.
Experiences of grandeur out in the backcountry. Personal moments of awe that you'd think he'd never be able to replicate anywhere else. And maybe nothing can match those completely. But I'm not going to shy away from claiming that Eric Pittman exudes no less wonder right at home when training his camera lens on a hummingbird. I'd like you to hear him recounting what happened about 15 years ago when, for the very first time, he became acquainted with Sweetie Bird. That's the name he gave to a mother Anna's hummingbird. A simple stroke of good luck brought Sweetie Bird into his life. She showed up in trees right out in his own yard.
I came into the backyard and I heard this peeping on a branch. I started to look for it because it was, I wasn't really aware that that was a chick. But when the mother showed up and had a longer tail and a longer beak and fed it, then I knew it was a chick. That was the first time I saw and recognized a mother hummingbird and a juvenile chick.
Sweetie Bird was kind of the spark for you. You saw Sweetie Bird, and that's all she wrote. You couldn't do otherwise now, and you're stuck.
It's one of those things. If you don't know about something, you can't care about it. Once I knew about Sweetie Bird, I had to care about her. She appeared in my yard, and I didn't know anything about hummingbirds. And I thought, well, that's great. Look at that. A hummingbird's in my yard. And I took pictures of her. I didn't think I'd see one again. But she kept coming back. They appeared to live in my yard. So I started to pay attention. And it wasn't very long after that that I found her sitting on a nest. And I thought, well, what an opportunity. I've been a photographer since I first discovered cameras as a kid. And I thought, well, I've got to get pictures of this. So I started to take pictures. And the first time that she came to the nest and the little chicks popped their heads above the edge of the nest to get the food, she had spread her wings. And it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got to keep filming her. So I just kept filming. And I never expected to film more than one nest. But she just kept having nests in my yard. So I filmed four nests that summer, and then another one at Christmas, and then another one just after Christmas. So it was six in a year. And they were all so different. And even in that period of time, she had the four chicks from the nests that were living close by. So I would see them as well. And I'd start to see them interacting with each other, and the older ones would sort of push around the younger ones and do all that. But it was just so fascinating to see this burgeoning little hummingbird society in my backyard.
I hope you've got a picture of what Eric is describing. Multiple nests, each with its own clutch or brood, typically consisting of 1 to 3 eggs. These young'uns are spaced apart in their various stages of development. Some are freshmen, some sophomores, others ready to graduate. When Eric first encountered Sweetie Bird, she was feeding some of her juvenile offspring that were old enough to be out on a branch. They were probably sophomores. Then, not many days later, she was simultaneously tending to hatchlings in a separate brood that were still too young to leave the nest.
Once a fledgling leaves the nest, it goes off and usually doesn't come back to the nest. If it does come back to the nest, it'll only be for a short period of time, like an hour or 2 hours. But they live outside the nest from then on. And they will go to what's called a nursery bush. And I name it that because that's what happens. They go to a certain bush and they'll stay there. And mom will come back and forth and feed them every 15 or 20 minutes. Usually, it's a bush down near the base of the tree that they hatched in, but sometimes it's a little bit further away. But they typically stay within about 20 feet, and they'll do that for about 2 weeks, at which point mother starts to wean them, and they have to learn how to feed themselves, and they do learn to feed themselves. The mother shows them how to eat. They learn by imitation, so she'll start to leap off a branch and grab little flies and come back to the branch, and the little chick will watch her, and she won't feed them. She'll just grab the flies. And eventually the little bird learns, oh, I've got to grab that fly, and it'll go off and do it. Or she'll find the little chick sitting on a branch with blossoms nearby, and she'll feed from the blossoms. And the chick will not get fed, but it pokes at the blossoms and goes, oh, that tastes good. And then it starts to learn how to eat. And this will happen over the period of about 2 weeks to 3 weeks or so. And the chicks never make a peep in the nest. But the minute they're outside of the nest, they start to peep. And they do that to attract the mother's attention because, you know, she has to find them once they've left the nest. And coincidentally, as they get weaned, they lose the ability to peep. So after about 3 weeks, a chick will never peep again. It'll develop its adult voice. It's like its voice cracks. You've probably heard young men speak when they are going through puberty and their voice cracks and That kind of thing happens to birds as well. It'll be peeping, but it'll go pee, pee, pee. And you can just tell it's trying to call for food, but it really hasn't got the language anymore.
To give a quick summary of things, mother hummingbirds can be found concurrently feeding hatchlings inside a nest and then flitting off to coach fledglings outside the nest. Each group requires a different strategy. To appreciate the multitasking here, imagine building 6 nests in a year. This isn't unheard of, not too much for a single mother to pull off. Well, actually, I should correct myself. It was unheard of.
So I've gone to lots of natural history societies and people in my area that do study birds, and they go, "Well, that's amazing. We didn't know that." They had no idea how many nests a bird had, how many nests a hummingbird had in a year, until I showed them.
Living in a place like Victoria, British Columbia, with its mild, temperate climate, Eric Pittman has the advantage of observing these hummingbirds year-round. At any given time, they might be found prepping a new nest for the next clutch, bringing food back to newbies just hatched, or coaxing fledglings to feed on their own. They are his neighbors, and he has watched them so closely that he knows how extensive the inventory of materials is that can be incorporated into a single nest. Over the last 15 years, he has followed around 140 hummingbird nests. By the way, a single hummingbird nest is tiny, only about 1.5 inches high and 2 inches in circumference.
A hummingbird has to make a nest with about 400 or 500 pieces of lichen, moss, hair, cattail seed, whatever. How does a hummingbird know how to do that? They start by just sticking things together on a branch, and then they start building things around it. They know when to bring in spider web to tie it together. Sometimes they use the spit from their own saliva, which is sticky because they've been eating sugared water, to help bond things together. And they'll use little plant things to build this nest. And how do they do that? They don't have any instruction manual, yet at a year old, hummingbirds are able to build a nest, and they then lay eggs, and they defend those eggs with their lives. And then they hatch the eggs and feed the chicks, and the process continues.
Lichen, little strands of spider web, is this stuff that you discovered? Did you cheat and read about this?
Well, I didn't. You know, strangely enough, I've become the authority on a lot of this stuff because I have the video footage to back it up.
You have said that you're hoping to document every hummingbird nest that you can and possibly in that process uncover something about their secret lives.
Right.
The way you're describing it, you're really turning up new things that had been secret and unknown heretofore.
There's really amazing things that I have discovered, you know, right from the social structure of the birds to their territories, how they build their nests, and the things that they do to keep their species going. These little birds are fearless. You would think that a little bird that only weighs 3 or 4 grams would be the most timid thing in the forest, but it's not. In fact, they will take on virtually anything in the forest that comes near their nest. But the only time that I have seen a group of hummingbirds work together is when there's a predator in their actual forest close to their nest. Every hummingbird within 100 yards will be there. I've seen them go after owls. There'll be 7 hummingbirds going after this owl. And the owl doesn't care. But the hummingbirds are vicious with it. Not that they go bashing into it, but they're constantly streaming around it and yelping at it and screaming at this bird to go away. But the fact that there's hummingbirds working together to do this is another amazing discovery. What else do birds work together on?
You know, whenever I hear stories about awe and wonder in relation to the natural world, I know of the very strong temptation that we all have to go for the romanticized story. When you're talking about the fierceness of these tiny creatures, it reminds me of one day feeling like I was being dive-bombed by a hummingbird. I think I was. I think I was in the territory. And there was this very characteristic diving pattern of coming down and making a giant U and shooting back up 40 feet into the air and then over and over again. Have you seen that?
Absolutely. The males do that mostly. The females will do it to a degree to scare you away from their nest, but it is a mating display that the males give. So when you see it, it means the male wants you out of there, usually, or the male is diving to impress a female that may be near you. And the key to it is that they always dive towards the sun so that they flash when they face the sun. When it reaches the bottom of its dive, it pulls out and does this screech towards the female, which is usually within a few feet of the bottom of the dive. And he tries to flash her with his iridescent feathers. And he can only do that if he catches the sun at the right angle. He's flashing his feathers, his iridescent red or purple, depending on the kind of hummingbird, towards the female, which excites her. She likes it. So it needs a sunny day to get this kind of activity. You hardly ever see them mating or hear them mating on cloudy days around here anyway.
There's another thing about this dive, though. As the male pulls out of the dive, he often produces a sound that you would think is halfway between a whistle and a chirp, but it's not a vocalization at all. Not coming from that tiny beak. That's the wrong end altogether. It's actually coming from his tail feathers. Think of splaying your fingers out wide on one hand. The male spreads his feathers out like that, just as wide as he can, but only momentarily, to generate that faux chirp sound. He has to be going incredibly fast to make it happen. We're talking about speeds around 50 miles an hour.
It's like a kid screeching his bike to impress a girl. He'll come in and he'll hit the brakes and he'll turn his bike and screech into the girl and go, "Hey, how do you like me now?"
And again, catching the glint of sunshine to brighten his feathers, that's a come on for sure. It makes perfect sense to me why Eric Pittman would suspect that rainy, overcast days along the coast of British Columbia really do have an impact on courtship behaviors of this region's hummingbirds.
One of the key things that I wondered about as I was filming the birds is that they would seem to hatch at the same time. There are times when I'm filming 5 or 6 or 7 nests with eggs in it, and I will take a walk and follow a routine with my dog and set up the camera and film this bird and watch her do something and then go to the next nest and the next nest and the next nest so that I have a library of each day with 6 or 7 birds. And many times those eggs will hatch within a day or 2 days of each other. So I've been filming all these eggs being incubated and then they all hatch at the same time. And I wonder, why does that happen? And my theory was sort of borne out the other day. We had about 3 weeks of overcast weather, so there wasn't much sun. And then I went out into the woods on a bright sunny day, the first one for a long time, and the male hummingbird was doing his mating. So I knew that, okay, they're going to fertilize their eggs and they're going to lay them and have some eggs and chicks. So I filmed him in Bailey's area.
Bailey is a female.
I thought he was going to mate with Bailey, and I think he did. But shortly after that, he was over in another area, and he was doing this display dance for another bird, and then for another bird, and 4 birds. He went for 4 birds this day. So why do they all hatch at the same time? Because they all got fertilized on the same day.
Now this Bailey, an Anna's hummingbird, is apparently rather feisty.
Bailey has a broken leg. I didn't discover it until I was filming her feeding her chick at one point. And when I slowed down the footage, I could see that her legs stuck out from her body at an odd angle. And I'd never seen this before. So I started focusing in on her more and watching her nest. And it was amazing that a hummingbird with a broken leg could actually make a nest and feed a chick and act like a normal hummingbird. It's one of those things that really tugs at your heartstrings. You see a bird that has to go through life. First of all, it only weighs 4 grams on the best of days. And here it is now handicapped because it's got a broken leg. You can't help it at all. But it still goes along with its daily life. It's still going to make a nest and raise a chick and fight the other hummingbirds off its territory. And I filmed her making a nest and raising a chick, and the chick fledged successfully. And so I started following her to see where else she may have a nest. And I found another nest, and she started to build it, and I was filming it, but it didn't come together well enough. And at one point, her eggs fell out of the nest, so that nest wasn't successful. And then I watched for, I guess, about 6 months, looking for her other nest. And we were very hopeful because she did a good job on it. We thought it was going to be a good, successful nest, and we thought that would add some drama to the film that we were working on. But we had a terrible storm, and it must have blown the eggs out of the nest or disrupted the nest enough so that they fell out. So that became one of the sad points of our film. But it still is a testament to how resilient these birds are. She continued on to be in the area, and she would come to me. I have a little flower feeder. I would put some hummingbird water in it to help her out, and she would come and drink from that while I was there. Eventually, she would come to my hand if I held it. And that was about a month ago, and I haven't seen her since. Now, that doesn't mean that she's dead or gone, because these birds only have to fly 100 yards in any direction, and I would have a hard time finding them again. So she may come back to that same area, or she may not. But she's added so much to my empathy of the birds that I'm forever grateful to her.
How close do you have to be able to confidently identify an individual hummingbird?
Bailey, I can see from about 15 or 20 feet away easily because of the way her leg sticks out. The other birds, I can tell which bird it is by where they are and where they're sitting and where they're perching. The mother hummingbirds have about a 50-foot radius around their nest that they don't allow other hummingbirds into. So when I'm watching a bird in a certain area and it's comfortable there, it's not getting a runoff, I know that that's, for instance, Bailey or Sunshine.
Another bird that Eric follows.
I'll see another bird come into that territory and she'll fight them off. So that one will go 200 feet away. If I go over there, that bird has its own territory.
Our guest for this episode is Eric Pittman. He's the subject of an award-winning documentary titled The Bird in My Backyard, and he maintains the popular Facebook page Hummingbirds Up Close. Stick around with us for a little while yet. You'll hear some wisdom from Eric that will help you nurture your own passion for nature. As a dad myself, I know it's a happy moment when I come across a podcast just right for the whole family. And we've got just the thing for you in the new show, Constant Wonder Kids. Constant Wonder Kids offers stories from the original BYU radio podcast, Constant Wonder, with accessible adventures for younger hearts and minds. Constant Wonder Kids goes out into wide open nature. It's designed for curious kids, but then, of course, also for the grown-ups who love those kids. Together, you can discover fascinating facts, true stories about remarkable people we interview who have had incredible experiences in their own encounters with nature. You get to join them as they dive down far under the ocean surface to meet things like, oh, maybe a friendly whale shark? Or back on land, you get to cheer along for tiny little hedgehogs that are athletes, if you can believe it, at the International Hedgehog Olympic Games. Constant Wonder Kids is perfect for road trips, for bedtime listening, or whenever your brain's got an itch that needs to be scratched. New episodes drop on Mondays. Tune in to Constant Wonder Kids on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. So I'm just going to put on my skeptic's hat. I am imagining a listener out there who is thinking, maybe this guy thinks he's watching the same bird day after day, but maybe it's really several different birds. Has anybody ever pushed you on that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I can show you video. I need to be truthful. I need the veracity to prove what I'm saying. And you can see in my videos, Sweetie Bird going from the chick to the nest and sitting on the eggs. In my yard, I have about six or seven trees that they like to nest in. And the pear tree is the most favorite. And then they've got two plum trees, and I've got a fig tree and a magnolia and some bushes. But she literally does a rotation between those trees. And if it were another bird, she would be fought off. There would be a lot of conflict between birds in that area. But that's also why it was so important for me to find Bailey, who has this noticeable difference with her leg sticking out at an odd angle. You can identify her easily. So that was very important to me.
We posed a hypothetical for Eric Pittman. What would happen to him if, after all these years of watching hummingbirds, for whatever reason, those animals all just went away? What would he lose?
Oh, I've never thought of that. I'd lose a place where I belong. I would end up searching for something else and another way to contribute. I would lose a unique insight and vantage point that I've been able to carve out that allows me to see this little world of wonder in an expanded view. I don't have to give up my memories, though, do I?
I never stipulated that, no.
Okay. So it would be
because you got some good ones.
I do have some good ones, yeah. It's such a small, intricate, and fascinating world to me that even if it disappeared, I could still go back to my films and dissect it and build on what I've filmed. There's so much complexity in all this little web of life that I've seen, that if I couldn't film anymore, I could still dissect my films, I could still interpret what happened, I could still create the stories around it.
As I think back to what you've said about your time in the Yukon those 40 years ago, I find it remarkable that you were in picturesque wilderness of such incredible grandeur. And today you're going for the minuscule little hummingbird nest.
It's one of those things that if you truly want to save this planet, you have to find something that people can care about. I go back to, if people don't know about it, they can't care about it. Everybody can care about a moose because you know what a moose is. But how do you protect a moose? You got to have a great big area. And in having that big area, you hope that a moose has enough environment to survive and to live and to prosper and do the moose kind of things that it has to do. But a hummingbird, you can take care of this microcosm in your backyard. So just by being aware and helping the hummingbird in the backyard, that's going to help the moose as well. Because you have now created a little sanctuary, and it's those spot-by-spot sanctuaries that connect to make the bigger environment.
You've offered so much that's rich in the way of insights into the experience of wonder as it relates to the natural world. Anything else you care to say on the topic or a personal take on how people can be transformed by wondrous experiences, by encounters with the phenomenal world around us?
People don't know that these birds that are helpless at that age, living on a hummingbird nest in your yard, even exists. So many people go out in the yard and they whack away at the bushes and they get the excess branches that they don't like and they throw them away without ever knowing if there's a hummingbird nest in there. So many people can't find them. Slow down and look around. And those things that you find attractive, go and look at them.
When I slow down in the way that you are describing, something happens to me. It can really put me in my place. I feel small and humble. And that humility, that's a spiritual thing for me. I'm not sure how you might put it, but I think that at some level you can probably relate.
Yeah, spiritual would be a way to put it. It does make me empathetic towards almost everything that I see. My wife, bless her heart, suffers with me for never cutting the branches. I hardly ever trim the hedges or disturb the flora in our backyard for fear of disturbing either a hummingbird perch or maybe disturbing a nest or something else. Because I love the natural world. I don't want to rake up the leaves because there's things living under there. I see the birds doing that. Leave the leaves where they are. Let the grass grow tall. Let the flowers bloom. I'm okay with that. I've said it's small little plots that build to make the big environment. And we all need to find a solace in this world. Or at least, we should, if we hope to be balanced human beings. We have to have some way of finding a place in this world. I've been able to find it by filming hummingbirds, and that's allowed me to grow a lot as a human being, not only in my empathy, but in my professional skills and in the way I live my life. It would be my hope that other people could find that as well in other parts of nature, so that they too can feel a fulfillment and come to a satisfaction of where we are in this world.
You can follow Eric Pittman and his hummingbird neighbors on his Facebook page, Hummingbirds Up Close, and you can see him in the award-winning documentary short titled The Bird in My Backyard. This episode was produced by Tenery Taylor with help from Elaine Scott. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.